All right, Mr. Brown, your next witness, please.
Our next witness is Stacy Hebert.
Ms. Is it Hebert?
Hebert.
I'm sorry. Okay. Ms. Hebert, as you heard me advise previous witnesses, your testimony is required to be under oath, and I'm required by law to advise you regarding perjury before administering the oath. Perjury is a false statement of material fact which you do not believe to be true. In North Dakota, perjury is a Class C felony, punishable by a fine up to $5,000, imprisonment for a period of up to 5 years or both. Will you raise your right hand? Being advised regarding perjury, Ms. Hebert, do you swear that the testimony which you're about to give in this matter shall be the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth?
I do.
Mr. Brown.
Thank you, Your Honor. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Could you please state and spell your first and last name for the record, please?
Yes. Stacy, S-T-A-C-I-E, Hebert, H-E-B-E-R-T.
Oh, you don't spell it correctly. That's the problem.
So I've been told.
I thought maybe that was my fault.
I might have to object to that, Your Honor.
I'd have to sustain your objection, actually.
And who is your employer?
Ottertail Power Company.
And what are your responsibilities there?
I'm the manager of supply services, and I am responsible for fuel and freight, which includes preparing fuel budgets and short and long-term delivered fuel forecasts that are used both for our IRP as well as internal budgeting.
Can you explain how Ottertail determined the delivered cost of fuel to the Big Stone plant in the Burns and Mack economic analysis for this case?
Sure. The delivered fuel forecast is made up of a fuel component, a freight component, and then we add in some other costs such as rail car leases, rail car maintenance, switching and storage fees, sales tax. And so the fuel component that we used was Woods and McKenzie fuel forecast from 2009, December of 2009. The freight forecast was also produced by Wood Mackenzie in the summer of 2009. And the delivered fuel forecast that we used for the AQCS analysis was the same fuel forecast that was used in our 2010 Minnesota IRP.
And can you explain how the actual transportation costs for coal are set for the Big Stone plant?
The Big Stone plant is under a tariff with the Burlington Northern, so they set the tariff rate.
And are long-term contracts available from BNSF for the coal transport?
We don't believe that we would be able to secure a long-term rail contract from the BN at this time.
And if long-term contracts are not available, has that been taken into account in Ottertail's economic analysis for this case?
To reflect the uncertainties related to a future fuel forecast, including both the fuel and the freight components, we looked, Burns and McDonald included a plus or minus 20% sensitivity.
Your Honor, we'd like to offer this witness for cross-examination.
Mr. Grumman.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
You indicated that long-term contracts are not possible with BNSF, in your opinion. Could you please expand upon that? Why not?
The Big Stone plant is a captive shipper to the Burlington Northern Santa Fe. That means that we have no other means of getting coal delivered, no other economical means of having coal delivered to the plant. It's not economical to truck it in. We can't bring it in by barge, and BNSF is the only rail that provides service to Big Stone plant. So because we are a captive shipper, we don't feel like we have much leverage at all with the railroad.
Going back to the Big Stone 2 advanced determination of prudence, I believe it was indicated in the order and during that hearing that you were essentially paying the highest possible rates possible. Is that still the case?
You know, when you say highest possible rates, I think in that case, what to me what that meant was that had we been paying a rate that was even slightly higher, we feel like we may have been successful in our STB case versus the BNSF being successful. Since our BNSF case, the adjustments to our tariff have been made on an annual basis, and they've been made using a railroad cost inflation index. That is something that's publicly available that we've been able to verify when the adjustments have been made, that they've been following that index. And so because our rate has been adjusted based on that index and presumably the other components that will be looked at in an STB case would have been increased by those same amounts, we feel that it's, while we haven't done the calculation, we feel like we're likely paying about that maximum rate.
In the Big Stone 2 hearing, the record indicated that 70% of the coal cost was BNSF transportation costs. How does the risk of BNSF price gouging compare to the risk of transporting, for say, natural gas? You'd expand upon that.
Well, one of the pluses of being under a tariff is that you have the ability to pursue rate relief at the Surface Transportation Board. One of the functions of the Surface Transportation Board is that they are to ensure that rates to captive shippers are reasonable. So in a situation where we would have felt that the BN was charging us an unfair rate, we would have the recourse of pursuing relief at the STB. You know, you wouldn't have that avenue when you look at natural gas pricing.
How many days notice is required before a BNSF rate increase can go into effect?
I can't remember if it's a 10-day or a 30-day notice.
Last, are you familiar with any utilities in the country recently been able to successfully challenge BNSF concerning price gouging, concerning coal transportation?
Yes, just in the last couple of weeks, Arizona Electric Power Cooperative was successful in a challenge of the BNSF and the Union Pacific Railroad before the STB. And I believe in that decision, they are to receive about $63 million as a result of that decision. And I think that serves as an example of a type of relief that is available to captive shippers.
Well, as you can imagine, from a ratepayer standpoint, if 70% of the fuel costs are for transportation, that instance is very intriguing. Is there somehow that the companies can expand upon that as a precedent to potentially lower your transportation costs?
To take a case before the STB is an expensive venture, and so you would want to be certain that you have some sense that you had a very strong case. And the last time that we did challenge the rate before the STB, we came close to winning, but we were not successful. You know, I think that is something that's available to us as a captive shipper. The owners have not been discussing since our last case a need to go before the STB. As I mentioned, our annual increases have been something that we can track and that we can understand. And we have not been receiving increases outside of those index adjustments. And so it's something that I would say is available to us, but it's not something that we're looking into at this time.
Would it be a correct statement to say that at least it's something that you're evaluating?
I wouldn't even say that we're evaluating it at this time because of the treatment that we've been receiving in terms of our annual adjustments from the BNSF.
Okay, thank you. I have no further questions.
Ms. Jeffcoat-Sacco.
I have no questions.
Questions from the commission. Thank you very much, Ms. Hebert.
Thanks.
I guessed wrong about your witness, Mr. Brown. We could have done that before lunch.
Yeah, that's right.
Your next witness, Mr. Brown.
Jeffrey Kopp, Your Honor.
Please be seated, Mr. Kopp. As you heard me advise other witnesses, your testimony is required to be under oath, and I'm required by law to advise you regarding perjury before administering the oath. Perjury is a false statement of material fact which you do not believe to be true. In North Dakota, perjury is a Class C felony, punishable by a fine up to $5,000, imprisonment for a period of up to 5 years or both. Will you raise your right hand, please? Being advised regarding perjury, Mr. Kopp, do you swear that the testimony which you're about to give in this matter shall be the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth?
I do.
Mr. Brown.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Could you state your full name for the record, please?
Yes, my name is Jeffrey Kopp, K-O-P-P.
And who is your employer?
Burns & McDonald Engineering.
And what kind of professional services does Burns & McDonald provide?
Burns & McDonald is a large engineering, consulting, design, and construction firm operating in various markets, including energy, transmission and distribution, infrastructure, and process and industrial services, and other markets, including a business and technology services unit that I work in that acts as our consulting arm for the company.
And what's your current position there?
My current position is the manager of project development within the energy consulting department within the business and technology services division.
And can you briefly describe your educational background?
Yes. I received a Bachelor of Science in Civil Engineering from the Missouri University of Science and Technology in 1999 and a MBA from the University of Kansas in 2004. I'm a registered professional engineer in the state of Missouri.
And can you describe your prior work experience before your current position?
Yes, I have a total of 11 years experience, and 10 of those are working in the power industry, 11 years in engineering total.
And doing what kind of work?
Mainly the consulting work within our business and technology services group, within the project development group. Prior to being the manager of that group, I was within that group, and we provide services, mainly studies for development of new power generation facilities, economic analysis of alternatives, and due diligence reviews of existing facilities.
Can you please explain your role in the evaluating the proposed AQCS project?
Yes. I was the Burns McDonald project manager for the pro forma economic analysis to determine the levelized cost of the Big Stone with AQCS compared to three alternatives for replacing Big Stone if the AQCS were not installed and it had to be replaced.
And was that evaluation, is that contained in OTP MDU Exhibit 115?
Yes, that is correct.
Do you have a copy of that in front of you now?
I
think it should be in one of those red wells. You can look for 115.
Yes.
Can you describe in general terms the type of economic analysis that Burns & Mac did in this case?
Yes, we did a levelized bus bar cost analysis where we looked at the cost of providing energy, electric energy, from each of the alternatives considered. And we calculated those into a levelized bus bar cost where we looked at the 20-year planning period costs, those annual costs, and those were calculated into a net present value. And from that, we calculated an equivalent annual annuity for each of those, which would give us a single number for each of the alternatives that would be equal to that 20-year planning period so that we could directly compare those, each of the four alternatives, with a single number.
And just so we can be clear on this, can you describe what it means to say levelized cost?
Yes. When we look at the 20-year planning period, levelizing those costs takes into account escalation throughout that 20-year planning period, and also the time value of money, to discount those back to net present values and then calculate an equivalent annual annuity that a client would be indifferent whether or not they got that 20-year stream or the levelized cost throughout that time period. So it would be the equivalent of that 20-year stream of cash flows.
And why was that methodology used in this case?
The reason that we levelize the cost is so that we have a single number for each of the four alternatives that can be compared directly rather than a 20-year stream of flows. So it's easier to compare those numbers directly to each other, those four alternatives.
And when you say four alternatives, you're referring to the proposed project and three alternatives to that project. Is that right?
That's correct. We looked at Big Stone with the proposed AQCS, as well as Big Stone being retrofitted to fire natural gas, a combined cycle plant to replace the Big Stone plant, or a combined cycle plant paired with wind to replace the Big Stone plant.
Can you describe the modeling assumptions that were used to do your evaluation?
Yes, there were quite a few modeling assumptions that went into our economic model, and they came from various sources. So I'll go through those based on what the source of the assumption was. So several of the modeling inputs came directly from Otter Tail's IRP to ensure that our results were consistent and comparable to Otter Tail's IRP. And those modeling inputs included O&M inflation, capital cost inflation, interest rate, return on equity, discount rate, the market price of wind power, and the fuel cost forecast.
Mr. Kopp, if I can just interrupt for a moment, what you're listing now is contained in Exhibit 115, is that correct?
Yes, this is all contained within Exhibit 115, starting at the bottom of the first page.
Okay. Were there any other modeling assumptions that you used?
Yes, so those modeling assumptions all came from the IRP. Then there were other modeling assumptions that came directly from Otter Tail, and that would include the costs for Big Stone with the AQCS. So that would include the net plant output of that retrofitted plant, the net plant heat rate, the net plant capacity factor, the capital cost, which was developed by Sergeant Lundy, and the annual O&M costs, both fixed and variable, which also came from Sergeant Lundy. And then if we looked at the alternative of retrofitting the Big Stone plant with natural gas, Otter Tail also provided us with the net plant output, the net plant heat rate, net plant capacity factor, the capital cost for converting it to burn natural gas, and the annual O&M costs. And again, both fixed and variable costs were included in that. They also provided us with a decommissioning cost for the Big Stone plant if one of the combined cycle or the combined cycle plus wind cases were to be included and were to be constructed at the Big Stone plant. The cost for decommissioning the existing coal plant prior to that, as well as for all three of the natural gas-fired alternatives, they provided a cost estimate for the linear facilities, which would include bringing natural gas to the plant to fire the new alternatives.
Presumably, there were some judgment calls that had to be made in identifying those assumptions. Is that correct?
Well, there's also some assumptions that were developed by Burns and McDonald.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, let me go through those real quick, and then we'll talk about how we determined some of those. So for the combined cycle alternative, we looked at, based on our recent experience with combined cycle plants, the net plant output, the net plant heat rate, the net plant capacity factor, capital cost, annual fixed O&M costs, and annual variable O&M costs. For the combined cycle plus wind case, we used that same combined cycle set of assumptions, but then paired it with a wind resource. And we looked at a capacity factor of wind of 40% to offset some of the dispatch of the combined cycle cost, therefore reducing the fuel expenditures on the combined cycle. And we looked at reducing the value of or the cost of wind to take into account the production tax credit. So in that instance, rather than dispatching the combined cycle at 75%, we dispatched the combined cycle at 35% and paired that with 40% wind energy capacity, or I'm sorry, wind energy purchases.
Can you describe the results of your evaluation?
Yeah. Well, let me back up to some of those assumptions and how we developed a few of those that Burns and McDonald developed internally. We jointly with Ottertail made the decision to make some conservative assumptions to ensure that the analysis did not appear to be biased in favor of the Big Stone plant. And it, to the extent that we made some conservative assumptions, we really gave the natural gas-fired alternatives a lot of favorable treatment to actually make the analysis somewhat biased in favor of a natural gas alternative. And so starting with some of the assumptions that we developed, the capital cost of the combined cycle, we looked at our recent experience with a 615-megawatt combined cycle plant, and we used that same dollar per kW capital cost and applied it to a 475-megawatt combined cycle resource to replace Big Stone. So that takes advantage of some economies of scale for capital as well as efficiency of the plant. All the gas-fired alternatives were assumed to be located at the Big Stone plant to take advantage of the existing infrastructure that's there. So that kept the capital cost down on those resources as well. The 40% wind capacity factor that we estimated is on the high end of the range that we would anticipate and is therefore highly favorable to that alternative. The heat rate of the combined cycle plant when paired with wind, we did not penalize it for part load operations, for cycling, starting up and shutting down to follow that wind. So it, again, got the most favorable treatment, assuming that it still had a very highly efficient operation. We assumed that the PTC was extended in every case that we ran. We did not run any cases with wind without the PTC. And then lastly, on the combined cycle and wind combined resource case, we did not burden that with any additional transmission, even though there's a lot more capacity installed there and an additional transmission would be required to support that alternative.
Okay. Anything else on the assumptions?
No.
Okay. Well, then could you describe the results of the evaluation?
Yes. Starting on table 2 within attachment 115 here.
On page 6?
Page 6, table 2, presents the base case modeling results. So that's under all the base assumptions that I just outlined. We present there, you can see the gray highlighted row, combined levelized energy cost, presents that levelized energy cost for each of the four alternatives we evaluated.
Excuse me, Mr. Goff, if I can interrupt for a moment. So the alternatives are shown across the top of that table. Is that right?
That's correct. So the four alternatives are shown in the four columns. And then we build up the costs, the levelized bus bar costs based on fuel, O&M, depreciation, return, interest, and income taxes to get the levelized revenue requirement. And then in the next line down, the cost of wind energy, when we pair a combined cycle with wind, we assume that that cost of wind energy for the 40% wind that comes into that case, and then the combined levelized energy cost below that for the four alternatives presents the levelized cost for each of those options. And as you can see, the Big Stone with AQCS is significantly less expensive than the other three alternatives and is approximately 42% lower, or the next lowest cost is approximately 42% higher than Big Stone with AQCS.
And again, just to confirm, when you're making that 42% comparison, you're looking at the combined levelized energy cost?
Correct. That's the combined levelized energy cost.
For the option shown in the far left-hand column, Big Stone plus the AQCS. Compared to the combined cycle plus wind.
Correct. Okay. We also ran a couple of sensitivities within that base case. The first one was a stranded asset cost. We were asked to evaluate what the impact of the stranded asset of Big Stone, if it were not able to operate in the future if we went with one of the combined cycle or the combined cycle plus wind alternatives. So we calculated that cost adder and included the total energy cost, including the stranded asset cost. So that's presented in the next gray highlighted line, and that's the only place within the study where we included stranded asset cost. And then lastly, we looked at within the base case, we looked at a high environmental cost scenario where we looked at if mercury control was required and if ash were to be deemed hazardous material and had to be handled as hazardous material, the cost adder for the Big Stone with AQCS. And that's shown that that adder was included, and then the total energy cost is shown directly below that in the bottom highlighted row.
Did you perform any sensitivity analyses beyond the base case?
We did. We looked at three main sensitivity cases, capital cost, and in that evaluation we evaluated any from a potential increase of 30% to a potential decrease of 30% in capital costs for all the alternatives considered. We looked at fuel costs.
Excuse me, Mr. Kopp, are the results of that analysis captured in Figure 1 on page 8?
Yes. So those results are shown graphically on Figure 1.
Can you just briefly describe how to read that particular figure?
Yes. Each of the four alternatives is presented in a different color line here, and the far left side of the graph shows the minus 30% case. The far right side shows the plus 30% case, and in the middle at the 0% would be the base case. So you can see throughout this wide range of potential capital costs evaluated within this sensitivity, the Big Stone with AQCS is significantly cheaper than any of the other alternatives, even if the capital cost of Big Stone were higher and the other alternatives were lower.
Okay. Did you do other sensitivity analyses?
We did. Next, we looked at the fuel cost, and we evaluated both coal and natural gas, the potential for those to increase by 20% from the base case forecast provided or decrease by 20% from the base case forecast provided. And those are presented in Figure 2.
Any other analyses, sensitivity analyses?
Yes. Lastly, we included an analysis of O&M costs. And again, we looked at a range of O&M costs increasing by 20% to decreasing by 20% for all the alternatives considered.
So after it completed its analysis, what conclusion did Burns and Mack make about the proposed project?
That under the base case, the next best or the next lowest cost alternative was 42% higher levelized bus bar cost. Even with the high environmental cost scenario adder, the Big Stone with AQCS was still the cheapest alternative, and the next lowest cost alternative would be 35% higher. And then for every case considered within our sensitivity range, the Big Stone with AQCS was the least cost alternative.
You provided rebuttal testimony in this case, is that correct?
That is correct.
And in your rebuttal testimony, I believe you responded to some of the points that were made by Mr. Hahn, the witness or the expert for the advocacy staff. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Could you summarize that testimony, please?
Yes. We responded to several of the points brought up by Mr. Hahn, the first of which was the fuel forecast that we used was outdated. And we specifically selected that fuel forecast to match the Otter Tail IRP at the time that it was evaluated. But we also ran those sensitivities to account for the potential that fuel forecasts can change over time. So that's why we ran the full plus or minus 20% sensitivity on the fuel forecast. Since that time, and within that range, Big Stone was the cheapest alternative, plus or minus 20%. Since that time, we were provided with an updated Wood Mackenzie natural gas forecast, as well as an updated Wood Mackenzie coal forecast, both of which decreased from the original forecast. And those forecasts were dated April of 2011. They both decreased, but both fell within the sensitivity range evaluated within our analysis. Therefore, those did not change our conclusion from our initial study. Next, we addressed the cost of wind power. And Mr. Hahn brought up a couple points regarding the cost of wind power. The first one was he referenced the Bison 2 and 3 costs that have been published for wind. Excuse me, the cost of wind power. But those costs are not really representative of the market, and mainly because the Bison 2 and 3 are going to use the Siemens Westinghouse SWT-3.0-101 direct drive wind turbines. Those will be the first production class of those turbines installed in the world. Therefore, it's typical for manufacturers to give a very aggressive pricing for the first units installed. So that's not really representative of the market. Second, he referenced the Lawrence Berkeley National Laboratory report that had some wind PPA costs. Those wind PPA costs, when we reviewed those, he quoted that that LBNL had witnessed PPA pricing for wind in the low to mid 40s in this region of the country. However, those pricing, that all that pricing was quoted in 2011 dollars, and the report said that those values all escalated at 2.5% from there. So we looked at those values, and we escalated those through a 20-year term from – we escalated them up to 2016, then escalated them for a 20-year term throughout that, and then levelized those prices. And if we used $40 and levelized that, we would be at a levelized cost of wind in 2016 dollars of $60.98. Or if we started at $44.02 and – in 2011, escalated that throughout the term and levelized it, we'd get a levelized cost of wind of $67.11 in 2016 dollars, which is identical to the value that Burns & McDonnell used that came from Otter Tail's IRP. So it would appear to me that the LBNL values are much more consistent with the numbers that were used in the Burns & McDonnell analysis than the values proposed by Mr. Hahn. And Mr. Hahn proposed a value of $42 a megawatt hour for wind energy. Also along those lines, on the cost of wind power, Mr. Hahn stated that we had underestimated the value of the PTC. There are two things that come into play there. First is the value of the PTC that we calculated or estimated was based on our prior experience running economic pro forma models with and without the PTC and our experience seeing those. And in 2009 dollars, we estimated that to be approximately $20 a megawatt hour. Mr. Hahn, his critique was that we needed to look at grossing that up to account for tax rates. We agree that tax rates do have an impact on that. However, it's a little bit more complicated than that, in that a lot of wind farms may have other issues that they have to deal with as far as monetizing that, the full value of that PTC, tax partner structures, things like that. And in our experience, it's been in $2009 dollars closer to $20 by the time you take all that into effect. We believe our number is more representative of the value of the PTC. But then secondly, we also believe that our value of wind with the PTC was consistent with the LBNL values. So really the only thing that would impact is if we added back in the value of the PTC, if it were taken away, to get what the value or what the cost of energy from a wind farm would be without the PTC. And we didn't run any cases without the PTC. Therefore, it's really immaterial to the analysis that we ran. Mr. Hahn also mentioned that we had included stranded costs in our evaluation and that we shouldn't have included those. Really, there was only that single case that I pointed out where we included the stranded costs. It was not included in the base case, and it was not included in any of the sensitivities run in figure 1 through 3. And then lastly, Mr. Hahn mentioned that we should have considered MISO purchases and looked at some other alternatives that included MISO purchases. The alternatives selected were based on replacing a baseload resource. So Otter Tail's, Big Stone is a baseload resource. We looked at the Big Stone with AQCS and compared it to three alternatives for replacing that baseload resource with another baseload resource. We did not consider MISO market purchases as a viable alternative baseload resource, and we did not consider a simple cycle combustion turbine as a viable alternative for, as a baseload resource either.
Your Honor, we offer this witness for cross-examination.
Mr. Grumman.
Your Honor, may I have one moment? Thank you.
You may.
Your Honor, we have no further questions.
Ms. Jeffcoat-Sacco.
Advisory staff, we were wondering if any sensitivity analysis had been run for, like, carbon prices.
We did not run any carbon sensitivities within this study.
Okay. Were they run then within another study?
They were considered in the Minnesota case.
And not run here because?
We were directed by Otter Tail that carbon was not to be considered within the North Dakota statutes. So that was my understanding, was that it was not included in, it should not be considered in this hearing.
Thank you.
Questions from the commission? Commissioner Calk.
Sounds like a pretty smart guy to ask a lot of questions to, so I better be careful here. I'm serious. Obviously, I've got a lot of good experience in it, you know, reading through your bio, a wide variety of projects around the country. And I guess you talk about the cost, you know, shoring them up at a certain time frame. Based on your experience, if you'd run that time out to 30 years, 40 years, and down the road, at what point do you guess would they would flip to a different alternative based on your experience? And what might that alternative be?
I guess I don't quite understand the question. You mean when it would flip from Big Stone with AQCS to another resource?
Something else, yeah, based on your experience. Because maybe it never would, but you've got a lot of experience. And my experience with time is that time variable really flips alternatives.
Yeah, I mean, I guess the way I would answer that is that, you know, under the assumptions that we included here, there's not necessarily a time where we're going to see it flip. What would cause that to flip would be potentially something that would drive additional capital costs on the Big Stone plant that may make it less economically attractive.
New environmental rule or?
New environmental regulations or drastic changes to the market that were outside of the sensitivity ranges that we evaluated for things like fuel costs.
Okay. And then next question is, reading through your bio too, you've had a lot of experience on decommissioning of coal plants.
Yes.
Throughout the country, quite honestly. When you go back and look at some of the things you've done before, is there one thing that really stands out as, okay, this is when this happens, that means this plant is probably going to be decommissioned? Or is everyone different?
Well, everyone's a little bit different, but, I mean, there's some generalities, I guess, that we've looked at recently, and that's typically facilities similar to Big Stone. Based on the economies of scale and the energy cost coming out of those resources, it's typically more cost-effective to retrofit those plants with the air quality control system. Some of the smaller plants, as Mark Rolfes had mentioned earlier, it's typically those that we see being slated for decommissioning where they're less efficient and less competitive on the market, and a large capital cost might push those over the edge to no longer being competitive.
Okay. And then the last question is just in your experience, have you ever seen where this hearing is all about an advanced determination of prudence, to where you can show a study somewhere that where by a company getting advanced determination of prudence actually is proved out to be lower cost to the consumer in the end?
I really can't answer that question. I don't have any experience either way on an advanced determination of prudence.
Okay, thank you.
Sorry.
Further questions from the commission? Follow-up, Mr. Brown.
Nothing further, Your Honor.
Mr. Grumman.
Nothing further.
Ms. Jeffcoat-Sacco.
Nothing further, thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Kopp.
Thank you.
Mr. Brown?
Your Honor, our next witness is Ward Udegroup.
Mr. Ugarud, I know you've done this probably more often than I have, but we both have to do it, I guess. As you know, your testimony is required to be under oath, and I'm required by law to advise you regarding perjury before administering the oath. Perjury is a Class C felony in North Dakota, punishable by a fine up to $5,000, imprisonment for a period of up to 5 years or both. Perjury is a false statement of a material fact which you do not believe to be true. Will you raise your right hand, please? Being advised regarding perjury, Mr. Ugarud, do you swear that the testimony which you're about to give in this matter shall be the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth?
I do.
Mr. Brown.
Thank you, Your Honor. Could you state your full name for the record, please?
Ward Ugarud, U-G-G-E-R-U-D.
And you're employed at Otter Tail Power?
Yes, I am.
Okay. What's your current position there?
Senior Vice President.
And what are your responsibilities in that job?
My responsibilities encompass the area of power supply, our generation facilities, our environmental services activities, and our wholesale power marketing activities.
And how long have you been at Otter Tail Power?
40 years.
Did you sponsor some of the exhibits in this case?
I did.
And does that include Exhibit Otter Tail Exhibit 201, your pre-filed rebuttal?
Yes, it does.
And does it also include Exhibit 202, Otter Tail's application for the ADP?
Yes.
And also Exhibit 203, Otter Tail's 2011 North Dakota 10-year resource plan?
Yes, it does.
And finally, Exhibit number 204, which was Otter Tail's Minnesota IRP for 2011 to 2025?
That is correct.
Thank you. You probably heard some of the questions that we've had earlier in the day about why the companies are seeking an ADP. Could you discuss that from the perspective of Otter Tail?
Surely. The air quality control system will be the largest capital project that the company has ever contemplated. And the implications relative to the financial performance of the company are so great that we made the determination that it would not be advisable, would not be the right thing for us to do to undertake that entire investment and then come before the commissions not only in North Dakota but also in South Dakota and Minnesota seeking rate recovery for those projects, with the risk that one of the regulatory commissions that is responsible for determining the eventual levels of rate recovery that we would be permitted, to find out that somebody would have taken a contrary view as to whether we should have done the project at all or not. So it was imperative that we come before the commissions seeking an advance determination as to whether there is an agreement between us and the regulatory commissions that this is the right thing to seek to do on behalf of our ratepayers.
What would the Otter Tail's response be if the ADP were denied?
Well, it would be an indication that this particular project is not one for which we could reasonably expect to achieve rate recovery. So we, in all likelihood, would have to come before this commission and the other commissions seeking a similar indication of approval on an alternative project. And it's our view that the alternative project that we would then come before this commission seeking the same determination on would be a higher cost project in the range of, as Mr. Kopp has testified, approximately 42% higher.
And what in particular would it mean for the Big Stone plant, at least as far as Otter Tail was concerned?
Well, it would mean probably a range of things. First of all, if this commission were to determine that the air quality control system was not prudent to undertake, it would certainly mean that Otter Tail's investment relative to its North Dakota load share would not be permitted. So we would probably then be faced with a scenario where we would, if we wanted to remain an owner of Big Stone, would probably have to seek to dispose of our North Dakota share of the unit to some other utility. The ownership agreement that we have in place would require as a first step that we offer that share to the other owners on a right of first refusal basis. Depending on the determination of other commissions, if, for example, Minnesota were to also deny the advanced determination of prudence, the possibility exists that Otter Tail would have to exit the project completely, which would in no way mean that the unit would disappear, but that the ownership under a denial of an advanced determination of prudence would likely change, and who the eventual owners, if any, would be unknown at this time.
There have been questions today about how the Big Stone plant fits within the generation fleet of both companies.
Right.
Could you describe, at least briefly, Otter Tail's current fuel mix?
Certainly I can. You asked earlier, you know, how long I have been employed by Otter Tail, and the answer to that is 40 years. As a part of the preparation for this case, I went and I took a look at what was the resource mix when I started with the company. And at that time, fully 90% of the capacity resources that the company had were baseload coal-fired resources. As things have changed over time, it has been increasingly difficult for utilities to build baseload coal-fired resources, primarily because of the high capital costs and the long lead times to get those projects accomplished. Quite simply, it's easier to build projects that cost less and can be done quicker than that cost more and take longer to do. So the change in our resource mix over time has changed so that currently, our resource mix is, on a capacity basis, about 65% coal instead of 90%. And I believe we have about 13 or 14% of our resource mix now is oil or gas, and about 20% on an installed capacity basis is wind. Otter Tail and all utilities are required to submit long-term resource expansion plans to the commissions that regulate us for their review. So on a biannual basis, we update our forward-looking view as to what our resource mix will be. And our current view, even under the assumption that we will continue to operate all of our coal-fired power plant resources, Big Stone, Coyote, and Hoot Lake. But just as our loads grow and the contemplation that our future resources will more likely be gas additions than coal additions, at the end of the 25-year planning period, at the end of the 15-year planning period, we would anticipate that our resource mix will have changed just through the passage of time. such that on an installed capacity basis, we would anticipate that our resource mix would have changed to about 50% baseload coal-fired resources, about 30% gas and oil resources, and about 20% renewable wind generation resources.
How does the AQCS fit into Otter Tail's 10-year plan?
Well, the AQCS in all of the studies that we have run shows that that is the least cost resource for us to pursue. And so as a result, the 10-year plan that we have filed with North Dakota includes, as a part of the plan, the continuation of the Big Stone plant with the environmental upgrades having been made and the resource still available. And similarly, the integrated resource plan, the 15-year plan that we have filed in Minnesota, also identifies the Big Stone plant with the environmental upgrades as the least cost resource, and it's shown as a continuing resource in that plan as well. So all of the plans that we have submitted in all of our jurisdictions shows that the Big Stone resource continues as a resource for the company and available to our ratepayers.
In his testimony, Mr. Hahn had suggested that the commission might consider certain conditions to attach to the ADP, and one of those was that the ADP should be effective only if EPA approves the South Dakota SIP in the form as currently proposed. Does Otter Tail have an opinion about that recommendation?
You know, generally, as we've reviewed that recommendation, it's one that would be acceptable to us. But again, I would probably put conditions on the condition. And if the condition was that the advanced determination of prudence was subject to the eventual EPA approval of the South Dakota SIP, that would be acceptable. It would be quite another matter if the commission were not to act at all until after the EPA had approved the SIP. That would introduce a lot of complications with regard to the ability to continue the project under the assumptions that we've made now relative to cost estimates and the timing of the ability to complete the work and things like that.
A second condition that had been proposed by Mr. Hahn was to limit the coverage of the ADP to the final actual cost at a rate of 10% above the current cost estimate. Does the company have a view about that proposal?
Yes, we do. We reviewed that, and again, it would be a condition that we would be willing to approve of subject to conditions. But it's my understanding that Mr. Hahn's recommendation also included that the company would be eligible to recover amounts above that if we could come and demonstrate before this commission that the costs in excess of 10% had been reasonably incurred, and that would be acceptable.
And a third condition was that the company should periodically report to the commission regarding the cost incurred and the status of the EPA review. Does the company have a view on that particular proposal?
Yeah, that we feel that that is also a reasonable condition, and in fact, we had anticipated that we would do that. We have been before this commission on other large projects and have offered to include periodic reporting as a part of other projects as well. We would certainly do that for this one.
Mr. Hahn also takes the position that the proposed activated carbon injection system for mercury control, so not part of the AQCS, but the mercury control, should not be included in the ADP because the EPA rule on mercury control has not been finalized. Do you have a view on that? Does Otter Tail have a view on that? Excuse me.
We do. Certainly, if the EPA were never to issue a final MACT rule, and if mercury control were never to be required, it would be understandable that we would not expect that the commission would grant cost recovery for the mercury control system. If, on the other hand, as we expect to be the case, that the EPA does issue a final MAC rule prior to the construction and completion of the AQCS project, that the most reasonable time for us to install that equipment would be as a part of this project. We had originally anticipated that there would be a final MAC rule in place before this hearing took place. We now believe that that has been delayed, but probably only by a month, and so we would expect, we fully expect to see a final MAC rule yet this year, even if it's not something that we see by the end of this year. We certainly think that it's more likely than not by far that we would see a final MAC rule from the EPA before this project is completed, and therefore it would be the reasonable thing for the companies to do to include it while we're undertaking such a major construction addition at the plant.
And finally, Mr. Hahn also suggested that the company should have evaluated an alternative based on MISO purchases. Can you explain why that wasn't included in the company's analysis?
Well, I think that it was probably not included in the company's analysis for the same reason that Mr. Hahn in his own testimony indicated that it would present a risk that, in my opinion, he was stopping short of suggesting that as a preferred alternative. Hypothetically, you can make a case that there is a scenario out there where market alternatives might be fairly economically attractive, but they also come with probably the most inherent risk in them because we don't know what the what kinds of things might impact future market prices. Now, I can remember one of the last times that Mr. Wall and I sat across from each other here. It was, you know, I was out here trying to explain to this commission why we had cost overruns that were resulting on, you know, a lot of calls to the Public Service Commission switchboard with regard to complaints with regard to the fuel clause adjustment for a project that Otter Tail had, wherein for a period of 1 month, we had Big Stone as a resource not available to us during the month of December, and market prices were high and customers were complaining about fuel cost impacts, and so we had a hearing on that issue, and it's happened before. It I believe will happen again. You know, customers, you know, markets are a volatile thing. We've seen it before. It will happen again. And one of the things utilities and I believe this commission as well are trying to do is to find reasonable ways to protect customers from the what-if impacts, and price volatility is not a pretty thing to get caught up in. I mean, there's a lot of blame to get passed around when that happens, and so the reasonable thing to do is to ward against it.
Your Honor, we're ready to present this witness for cross-examination. For the record, I just would like to note again that this witness is offered only for the record for Otter Tail Power.
Mr. Grumman.
Thank you, Your Honor. Mr. Ugarud, you were here this morning, and you were here for Mr. Rolfe's testimony and cross-examination. Is that correct?
That's correct.
My question is, of course, there was significant testimony concerning the Coyote plant. And from a ratepayer standpoint, we're curious if, under the contingency that the Coyote plant were to have a fuel source change from lignite to Powder River Basin coal, or I guess other than some other coal for that matter, would the company be willing to first come before this commission and ask for an advance determination on that matter?
You know, I think that I'll answer the question yes at the beginning. I see no reason why we wouldn't do that. The only comment that I would offer is that from my perspective, at least, and again, I'm not even necessarily answering on behalf of my company, but just me and the experience that I've had within my company. There's a part of me that thinks that the ADP statute was contemplated for the review of large capital projects that took a significant lead time. And so the only thing that surprises me about the question is not so much whether we would be willing to do that or not, as much as it is whether or not that's the kind of project that would have otherwise fit with my determination of what an ADP statute was intended to cover. But certainly the issue of the relationship between Otter Tail Power Company, Montana Dakota Utilities, and the state of North Dakota relative to the Cayo project is not something that we would be unwilling to pursue decisions such that the results and the impacts on the retail customers that we serve are impacted by decisions that are mutually acceptable between us and the commission. So I would offer that, at least from my personal opinion, if there was a feeling that this commission would think that that would be an appropriate thing for us to do, I personally would not advise against doing that.
Thank you. I have no further questions, Your Honor.
Is Jeff Kotsacko?
I have one or two. What is the company's, how would the company describe the question for the commission in this case? What is the factor or the question that the commission has to decide in order to decide this case?
Well, I think that the question is the relatively simple one, and that is, based on the things that we know now, and given that Otter Tail and Montana Dakota Utilities are going to have to make a major decision to do something, we cannot continue to run the Big Stone plant unless we add environmental controls to achieve resolution of the regional haze issue. So given that as the backdrop, the question is, given what we know now and given the fact that the company has to do something, and these are the conditions that we face in terms of the cost of alternatives and the prices, what would you rather have us pursuing, this or that? And we believe that the question is that simple, and we think that in this case, that based on the evidence that we have, that it's not necessarily even a close call, but it's still something we wanted to have a mutual determination on.
Can you fit that into the advanced determination of prudence law for me and tell me what the question is the commission needs to decide?
Well, is it reasonable for us to continue to be pursuing this specific project based on the evidence that we have put before you? And we think that's what this case is all about.
And is there any relevance or meaning to the concept of advanced determination of that?
Well, you know, the alternative would be to spend the money and then come in and seek rate recovery for the dollars that we had spent. So that's the difference between advanced determination of prudence or reasonableness versus cost recovery at the completion of a project. But with the dollars involved being as significant as they are, if there's a risk that a regulatory commission would have rather that we'd done something else, and we don't have the benefit of knowing that feeling from the commission until after the money is already spent, it becomes a bet the farm type decision. And in today's times with all of the issues out there surrounding utility and energy related issues, that just would seem like a risky proposition to us to wait until after we've spent the money to get any feedback as to whether that was the right thing to have done or not.
So you could probably live with a decision, a positive decision on prudence at $0, and the dollars could be figured out later. Is that kind of what I'm hearing?
Well, in fact, I think that our testimony has indicated that, you know, we're certainly thinking that all of the dollars that we spend, that's why we would agree to the periodic reporting. That's why, you know, we certainly don't think that we've been given a blank check. You know, I'm proud of Mark Rolfes and the work that he has done, and, you know, we certainly intend to execute this project with a degree of concern for the final rate impacts on our customers. There is no way that we would treat this as if we've been given a blank check to spend $489 million. And we fully support that we'll come in and show that from the beginning to the end that we did the things that we think were reasonable for us to do as a part of what we do as a utility.
I just want to be sure we're on the same page.
I think we are.
You want to know, you're using this statute in order to know if the commission thinks you're doing the right thing or the wrong thing.
Right.
Thank you.
Questions from the commission. Commissioner Clark.
Thanks, Ward. walk me through something that has been nagging at me since lunch.
You can't do anything about
yeah,
the soup.
Yeah. No. Something I contemplated over my soup. It's the way in which Minnesota has split its ADP decision with regard to the baghouse. Because it seems to me this may put our commission and our ratepayers in a very odd position, and here's why I say that. As I understand it, you wouldn't do the other parts of the project without being able to do the baghouse, that they're inseparable. In other words, from an engineering standpoint, that which takes out the SO2 and the NOx requires you to revamp your baghouse. So in effect, has Minnesota really granted you anything, right? Because they severed out a part of the project which is inseparable from the first two parts of the project. So do you have really any advanced determination of prudence at all in Minnesota?
Well, we think we do. You know, we don't have a final determination by the Minnesota Commission. What we have in Minnesota is a recommendation from the administrative law judge and the position that the Department of Commerce has taken in the case. And if that was fully the basis on which a decision were to be rendered today, I would say that taken together, what we have in Minnesota is a determination of prudence. What the Department of Commerce has said is that they think that the costs of the baghouse should be fully recoverable, but that portion for which the advanced determination of prudence has been given does not cover the baghouse, but they have said in their recommendation that the baghouse is a reasonable thing to do and that the company should seek recovery of that portion in separate rate-making processes.
If I can just stop you for a second, but that doesn't that really then tie the hands of the entire project to that same theory, where really you would need to be seeking recovery for the whole project in a separate project, not advanced determination, not in an advanced determination, because you can't sever the baghouse from the rest of it.
Well, that's not our interpretation of the combination of the two things in Minnesota. Right. We believe that our interpretation is that the administrative law judge has said that the remainder of the project is prudent, and that the cost portion of that total project would just be recovered through a separate rate-making considerations. One of the things that's interesting in Minnesota is that the administrative law judge himself has approached it kind of the same way you are, and that is that, you know, it seems to the administrative law judge that a case can be made that the baghouse should be considered as a part of the total project, and he's in a kind of a separate memorandum to his recommendation raised that issue as to whether or not the department's position relative to the baghouse is the right one or whether a different one should be taken. You know, the issue of the AQCS is far more important to Otter Tail than the relatively small portion of bag house or no bag house. I mean, it's far more important to us to have a determination on the concept of installing environmental upgrades on the plant. We don't want to get caught up in a fight in Minnesota relative to nitpicking on that baghouse issue or the non-baghouse issue, particularly when the Department of Commerce has said that they think that the baghouse is reasonable to do and that it should be recoverable in final rates.
When is the final decision expected from the Minnesota Commission?
You know, we expect it in mid to late December. Okay. It's not been set for an agenda in front of the commission yet, so which day that will happen, we're not sure. But if it's not in mid to late December, we expect that the commission will hear it shortly after the first of the year.
Thanks. I'd ask our judge, is there an appropriate way to make sure that that decision can be incorporated into our record? Is another agency's decision something we just take administrative notice of, or is that something that, knowing maybe coming up in the next few weeks, we're allowed to be filed as a late filed exhibit, or do we have to reopen the record again to get it in? I'm just trying to figure out what the right way is so we can take that into consideration.
You've got to think about that a little bit, but I invite counsel's comments.
Your Honor, I think that at least from Montana, Dakota, we would stipulate to providing a copy of the commission for its consideration.
For what purpose? Is it evidence or is it, it's not precedential, clearly, but is it evidence?
I don't think it's evidence of a fact other than that's what the other commission did. It's evidence.
It's evidence of what they did.
What they did.
But the findings are not...
No, I mean, you can't adopt their finding of fact as your finding of fact.
Or accept
evidence
that,
of what their action right. was. And I think the other thing that's probably important in here, and I wasn't involved in the Minnesota proceeding, but you've got two different statutes. And I think you've got to recognize the distinction between the statutes, and that might play into how that affected your final decision. But I think from Montana and Dakota's standpoint, we would have no problem submitting that decision as part of the record in this case, understanding that it's not it's only a fact for that, what the commission decided.
Exactly, for that purpose. I would agree with that. I'm sorry, Mr. Bring, do you wish to comment?
Well,
Ottertail Power stipulate to the decision as a late filed exhibit, I guess, is a fundamental question.
Yes, Your Honor. While I've not done research on administrative notice, I suspect that it would be capable of being administratively noticed as evidence of what the Minnesota Commission did, and Ottertail would be willing to stipulate to its entry into administrative notice if that's the desire of the commission.
Is that the thing to close? I mean, we've taken notice of these in the past. It's just been that it's been after the record was closed, and it caused us to have to go back and re-notice things. I'm just trying to avoid that, unless we have to do it that way.
No, we can do it as a... I would agree it can be a late file exhibit. Let's just make it part of the record. So, Mr. Brown, is that going to be 117 then?
The next exhibit would be 117, Your Honor.
All right. For the record, when the decision of the Minnesota Commission is available, it can be filed as a late filed exhibit, exhibit number MDU OTP 116, I guess.
Thanks. Were there other parties that were interveners in that case who held a different position than the DOC who may be likely to appeal that decision?
With regard to the baghouse only?
Well, with regard to the decision in general, with regard to the ADP for...
Yes.
Okay. Well, and I mean the reason I ask, and the reason that I am interested in having the Minnesota decision in our record, at least as just a fact, is because we've run into this issue before in other cases, as you know, where litigation and things going on in one state can have a tremendous impact on others, and I think it's something that we as a commission need to have our eyes wide open as we go into this so that we're not exposing our ratepayers to unnecessary risks because of regulatory and legal and legislative uncertainties in another state.
And, Your Honor, if I might, and this might be slightly out of order, but perhaps not. If I could go back to the baghouse a little bit, and I think that it's probably important to put that into the context of how that whole issue arose and evolved over time. What the South Dakota DENR and the state implementation plan first did was set an emissions limit for particulates. And what they concluded was is that the current baghouse provided for an emissions limit for particulates that was consistent with the requirements of the regional haze program. And that was embodied in the state implementation plan and the prescription for the emissions level of reduction requirements. As we got into doing the engineering then to achieve the various emissions rates that were specified in the state program, it wasn't until then that we determined this issue that Mark Rolfes had addressed earlier this morning with regard to the increase in the negative pressures. And just because of all of the additional equipment that we've installed, we're going to have to install newer, larger induced draft fans, and we would literally just suck the sides of the box that the baghouse sits in, just because of the increased pressures. And so when you take a look at, okay, the baghouse is performing at a level that meets the state implementation plan requirements, but the cost of going in and drilling new foundations and putting in new metal supports on a piece of operating equipment while the plant is still running, it would be prohibitively expensive to do that on an operating piece of equipment, and it was just cheaper to go in and build something new that we can cut over during that proposed 2015 outage. And so we get caught up in Minnesota in terms of the semantics of the original state implementation plan prescription in terms of an emissions reduction standard. And I'm kind of perplexed a little bit as to why Minnesota would be taking the position, well, because the South Dakota rule said this, that therefore we're not going to allow the new baghouse to be considered as a part of the project, when from my perspective as an engineer, you just go in and you're going to do the least cost way of, at the end of the day, achieving the result you need. And so I think that the whole issue has kind of been blown out of proportion. I don't think either the Department of Commerce or Otter Tail disagree that at the end of the day, the least cost thing to do is to build a new one. We just get caught up in the interpretation of that original South Dakota.
Right, state. But that's actually, I guess, part of the question for my concern, and what I'm trying to nail down here is that, if Minnesota is doing things that create uncertainty in the process, to what degree should we be putting North Dakota ratepayers on the hook until we really know that they've finally signed off on this? Because we have had a track record, and frankly with that state in particular, of trying to block projects if they have anything to do with coal.
But it's my understanding that what we have in Minnesota right now is a record that would support the environmental control upgrades and the new baghouse. They're just separating out the baghouse portion for a different rate recovery treatment and have given us an advance indication that they believe it's the right thing to do.
Sure. And I'm just trying to nail down when we'll have the final answer from Minnesota. I don't know if you had an opportunity to answer this yet or not. Could you detail the other interveners that have been active in that particular case?
You know, it's the a coalition of interveners, and I'm not sure that I can get all of them, but it's the Minnesota Center for Environmental Adequacy, the Isaac Walton League, the Sierra Club, the Cure... fresh energy. There's a group of a handful of them that got together, and it's a joint and they refer to themselves as the joint intervener.
And is it a general opposition to the upgrade? They prefer the plant be shut down. Period.
They would.
And has there been an indication if the ALJ decision, if it's ultimately adopted, if it'll be appealed? Or can we assume one way or another that it will?
I suppose I'm not sure that I could answer as to whether it would be. I certainly think there's a possibility those people have appealed other things. And
okay. Fair enough. Thanks. That's all I have.
Commissioner Kramer.
A couple of things I just want clarification on, Ward. Thanks for your testimony. First of all, I want to be clear about this issue of if I understood your answer to Mr. Grumman's question, are you asking for advanced determination of prudence on this to include these mercury controls in the possibility or likelihood of the MACT rule being passed, but wouldn't expect recovery of those costs if the MACT rule isn't passed? In other words, how would we deal with that if we were to give an advanced prudence but then renege on that part of it later? Or didn't I understand you correctly?
Well, I apologize if my answer was vague and confusing. We believe that the likelihood of MACT is so probable that we think it would be an appropriate determination for the commission to say that the baghouse that the ACI portion, the mercury control, is reasonable and prudent, but would be willing to live with the condition that you might put on it, that it's subject to a final MAC rule that would require it.
Okay. Okay.
And if there is no final MAC rule, then we would have to make a determination whether we do it or not. But we think that it's likely, and our recommendation would be that if you want to put a condition on the ACI portion for mercury control, that the prudence of that is subject to a final MAC rule before the project is complete.
That makes sense. Thanks. Now, knowing that, of course, you're the historian in the room, and this issue of that I think Alana was getting at a little bit over the distinction of an advanced prudence versus prudence after the fact, and I think you answered the question fairly well, but one of the things that haunts me, and maybe you can help me given your historical perspective, is prior to the Big Stone 2 case, why was there never a request for an advanced prudence on previous investments, large capital expenditures, fuel choices, all of those things? If today it's so urgent, it seems to be almost critical.
You have to keep in mind that there's a number of dynamics in play here. First of all, Otter Tail is not engaged in a large capital project since the installation of Coyote. So there's never been an occasion for us to have a project that we're sponsoring that would seek such a determination. I can remember at the time that we constructed Coyote, and then the standard for regulatory recovery was used and useful. Mm-hmm. And we had a significant proceeding before this commission, and there was a determination made that the block of capacity associated with the Coyote project put Otter Tail in a position of having excess capacity, and that therefore that there was a portion of that investment that was not used and useful at the completion of the project. And I believe we had to file a total of 3 rate cases in order to have all of the investment in Coyote included in rates and receiving cost recovery. And that represented a hardship for our company. As a result of that experience at that time, Dennis Emmon, who was our senior vice president of finance at the time, I can remember discussions internal at our company saying, that was such a difficult thing for synchronizing the expenditure of dollars and the recovery of the investment that we would never undertake another large capital project without having some mechanism to go and get an indication beforehand, because this notion of potentially spending that much money and then having significant delays in being able to recover the investment would be an untenable situation. So while this may be the first time we're before this commission now seeking such an advanced determination, it's certainly not the first time that we've had discussions among our companies as to what do we do for projects that have got such large capital expenditures and that you spend dollars over such a long period of time before you have a project that's in service and producing energy.
That's fair enough. I mean, that's a good, what I was looking for, historical perspective. Because one of my, you know, one of my concerns is it almost seems like this trend or need for an ADP can be paralyzing. On the one hand, it's like either we get it or we don't do anything, or you go ahead and you do things, and companies have done both since we've had the law, and things that we might not have approved of had we known in advance. And so then it's hard to get on the right side, I guess, of the commission, because determining something after the fact is so much easier. But when we end up sharing in sort of that management decision of what things to build, it makes us a little uncomfortable. At the same time, we get pretty owly if a bad decision is made. So that's more of a statement perhaps for your response than anything.
It's a fair statement. Mm-hmm. And there may be that there's, you know, as time passes and we evolve relative to the way in which industry and the regulatory community view some of these projects, there may be better ways to deal with such things. But certainly from our perspective, you know, we don't want to spend the money only to find out that somebody thinks we shouldn't have, and therefore we've poured money down the drain. And on the other hand, I can certainly appreciate the dilemma that you people face too, and it's the same one that we face. You know, things change all the time, and viewing some of these things with regard to a unknown future is a difficult thing to do.
And then, yeah, I agree. Thank you. And finally, we've never been able to really nail down a way to determine the actual savings of an advanced prudence determination, especially capital costs. And we hear it seems reasonable, it sounds rational, that, you know, the markets were going to favor certainty versus uncertainty, and yet no one's ever been able to sit in that chair and say, yes, the cost of capital is this much less with this prudence. Is that expecting too much?
Well, there are opinions out there as to the degree of savings. I think Scott Hempling is somebody that maybe you guys have run across in some of your commission proceedings. I think he's actually authored some papers and has put some sort of a financing savings associated with regulatory certainty, and it's not an inconsequential amount. I think I've, you know, read in Public Utilities fortnightly articles that talk about the benefits of regulatory certainty with regard to lowering financing costs. But I have seen various things that people have hypothesized that show savings that are worth achieving in terms of regulatory certainty relative to the financial world's view of the safety of investments in a project.
Thank you. Nothing else.
Further questions from the commission? Commissioner Calk.
Thank you, Ward, for your testimony. And you work for Otter Tail Power. It's been a couple days. Huh? You know, Kevin and Tony and the folks always do a pretty good job, a real good job of laying out most of the questions and try to fill in a couple of the gaps. The one that I guess I keep struggling with is the one that Kevin talked about, Tony talked about, is the whole deal about if this commission, I'm speaking for myself, of course, only, but if we'd reject an ADP, that doesn't mean that wouldn't think it's a good project down the road. And that's one thing that I've heard a lot in the hearing today is that people seem that if we don't approve an ADP, doesn't mean down the road that we'll think it's a good idea. I think for me personally, that's completely wrong. I mean, we'll just have to look at the facts of those cases that come up. So I'll just throw that out there. Tell me this, if Big Stone 2 had been built, would there have been any of this air quality control system that would have not have been included in that?
Yes. Big Stone 2, as proposed, would have had a single joint scrubber. And so there would have been a economy of scale potentially achievable with one large scrubber that would have serviced both units. On the other hand, the Big Stone 2 project did not have associated with it an SCR.
Okay.
So the subsequent regional haze review and determinations would have exposed us on the unit number one to an SCR in any event, and the scrubber would not have been free.
Okay.
There would have been a need for unit one to be scrubbed. It's just that rather than the partners paying for the cost of a standalone scrubber as we now propose, we would have been responsible for paying our share of a joint scrubber size large enough to handle both units.
Okay, thank you.
For Commissioner Clark.
Are there similar proceedings to this going on in South Dakota, or do they not have an advanced principles type procedure?
They don't. And in South Dakota, you have to keep in mind that because the unit is located in South Dakota, the very need to do this project is a function of administrative and regulatory things that have been happening in South Dakota. So that we view the situation in South Dakota to be different. South Dakota, on the one hand, can say, these are the things that you need to do at this unit, and then turn around and separately say, oh, by the way, we don't think you should have, because we're responding to what they're telling us to do. But then separately, there is also a rate stability plan in South Dakota, so that the combination of what South Dakota has required by virtue of the requirements of its state implementation plan plus the regulatory treatment of their rate stability plan gives us the same degree of assurances in South Dakota that we seek in North Dakota and Minnesota through a different process of advanced determination.
So ultimately, what cases will need to be filed in front of the South Dakota PUC? Do they have to, are there any, is there a certificate of need that will be required, or
but there's the
or siting?
All the permitting associated with the work that we're doing at the unit.
Okay, so they'll have to do a siting case, is that,
and,
or?
You know, I'd have to, you know, go back and rely on Mark Rolfus and Terry Grauman for the exact litany of permitting issues involved in Minnesota in this project, but there are certainly issues before the commission and the DENR relative to the specific requirements of what we do in South Dakota to implement the project.
Okay. Maybe Mr. Rolfs can come up and testify, or else if there's a late filed exhibit we could have just detailing what permits will be required in that state, that might be helpful as well. Or we could just handle it today.
The biggest of them that I'm aware of is the construction permit.
Further questions from the commission? I'll deal with that, Commissioner, in a minute here. Further questions from the commission? Follow-up, Mr. Brown.
Your Honor, there would be some issues I'd like to get into that pertain to the Minnesota case. I was the counsel of record for that. It might be easier if you would allow it that I might just report on that. It's all relating to procedural matters there, but it seems to be of great interest to the commission.
All right. I wish to confer with counsel anyway. I have my eye on a recess at the moment.
Okay.
So let's just, can we finish with Mr. Ugarud? Mr. Brown, any follow-up specifically for Mr. Ugarud?
No, if we were unable to get it in through some sort of statement from counsel, I might want to recall this witness to go further with it, but I don't think it'd be productive to do it at this time.
All right, let's talk about that.
Okay.
Mr. Grumman, follow-up?
No, Your Honor.
Ms. Jeffcoat-Sacco, follow-up?
No, I had follow-up on the topic of the order and the Minnesota law, so I'll do that when you get to that with the other counsel.
Okay. Let's Let's take a recess. First, may I say again, please, to anyone who is present, to any member of the public who is present, if any there be, that if you wish to address the commission concerning either one of these cases, I ask you please to talk with me during the recess or at the close of the proceedings today, assuming that we will continue tomorrow. And the same with anyone who is listening to the Internet stream. If you have in mind to address the commission concerning any of these cases, please also arrange to talk with me to arrange to do that. And finally, then let me talk to let me have a conference with counsel during the recess. And we will be in recess until 2:30 at least.